Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining us on Inner Spark Radio, a weekly show in which we talk to experts about ways to ignite the spark within. My name is Lena Gazurian, and you can learn more about our upcoming shows at innersparkradio.com and on Facebook at Inner Spark Radio. I'm really looking forward to talking with today's guest, Chevalisa Brazone, a licensed marriage family therapist, because I studied with Chevalisa, and I know the passion and insight she will bring to this conversation. Chevalisa has a psychotherapy practice in the South Bay and Santa Cruz, California. She has extensive training in the mindfulness-based Hakomi method and currently studies with Stan Tatkin, who just won the Teacher of the Year Award at the American Association of Marriage and Family Therapy California Division. In addition to seeing clients and teaching couples how to create securely functioning relationships, Chevalisa works at Stanford University teaching emerging business leaders how to cultivate their emotional intelligence. Welcome, Chevalisa.
Hey, thank you.
Yay. So before we get into attachment theory and the relationship essentials, it would be great if you would share some of your own experience and journey with attachment and relationships.
Okay. I can do that. And before I share anything, I think I would like to just say that this is a caveat that I wrote a blog this week about this show, and the word I use there is that I consider myself an obsessive fan of attachment, not an expert in attachment. So this is an edge for me to be stepping out and really sharing my passion with a larger audience than just a friend at a cocktail party or with a client. So I want that to be known, that this is a working edge for me, and I'm really thrilled to be here and to have an opportunity to walk this edge and share this information, because I think it's really exciting and important. So that's my caveat.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and in terms of how did I get interested in attachment theory, and which is sort of the broad theory that I'll be drawing from today, I have a little bit of a dramatic life story, which starts in a very stable way. I was born in 65 in a middle-class family here in the Bay Area, and this feels really important for me to say that my parents wanted me. They planned for me. I had a very stable home life. I had parents who really loved me and cared for me, and that's the environment I popped into and grew up in. Very stable elementary school, high school, went off to college, was at UCLA, and then in the very last quarter of my college experience, spring quarter of 1987, 6 weeks before I was about to graduate, I had a nervous breakdown breakthrough experience. I had a kind of a, one way I like to describe it is a spiritual awakening that happened so quickly that I just lost my marbles. I could not metabolize what was happening. My nervous system was so stressed out that I started to have really crazy ideas about how life worked. My self-care went way down. I wasn't sleeping. I wasn't eating. I was more in love and more safe than I'd ever been in my life, but I couldn't function in that state of expansiveness.
Chevalisa, sorry, can I ask you a quick question? Sorry.
Sure.
Just a quick question. In this, when this started to happen, just 6 weeks, was there anything that you could ever point to that precipitated it in any way, or did it seem to just come from nowhere?
Well, I will. Yeah. So,
are you going to get to that?
No. It's a great question, and I welcome any and all of your questions. There are some markers. Apparently, when people have these kind of breakdowns, they often start in the early 20s. They often come at a stressful transition in life. I was about to graduate from college. And they often happen in the spring, like when all the sap is rising and the energy of the planet is changing, it can activate people's nervous system. I also was experimenting with drugs at that time and smoking a lot of pot. And that's a trigger. So I think there's any number of things. I think one consistent through line, though, of all that is that I did not have a stable nervous system. So any one of these triggers or even all of these triggers could have happened to somebody else, and they would have been able to sustain it. but because I had, because I believe that I have a nervous system that was not fully online, which is what I want to talk about today, this attachment stuff, I think I was more susceptible to really crumble with the stress.
Mm-hmm.
So I did. I crumbled. I ended up on, thankfully, a friend recognized my symptoms. She'd seen it before. I lived in a sorority house at that time with 65 women. And one of my sorority sisters walked me to the hospital, which was a 10-minute walk. UCLA Medical Center was right across the street. And next thing I knew, I was in lockdown on a psychiatric ward, which was a huge, huge experience. As you can imagine, it's probably the best thing that ever happened to me, but also the worst thing that ever happened. And out of that, my whole life changed. My whole life went in a completely different direction as I sought for the next 25, 30 years, I have been seeking to understand what happened and to integrate that experience into my life.
Mm-hmm.
So I received a bipolar diagnosis. My behavior looks like bipolar. It might be bipolar. I've never been back in a hospital, and I managed to stay. I was on meds for about 3 months, and I didn't like it, so I got off the meds, and I've managed to have a lifestyle. I've been lucky. I don't think everybody with bipolar gets this lucky, but I've been able to have a pretty high-functioning life without meds and without returning to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So knock on wood, I consider myself lucky in that department. What I did notice, though, as I went over the next, you know, I'm a tracker, and I like to journal and write and reflect on things, and as I looked at my life over these years, I kept noticing that my highs and my lows, without any exception, my highs and my lows happened around relationship stuff. I would be attracted to somebody, I'd shoot up, and I would be kind of mildly manic for a couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would get rejected by somebody, and poof, I would collapse, and I would be depressed, sometimes bedridden depressed, again for a handful of days. And year in and year out, I noticed this theme. It was so consistent. And so that got me curious. And it took me until I was in my 40s when I finally got into therapy and then concurrently started graduate school. And with the intent of kind of studying what is this bipolar thing and why, what's going on with it. And so a couple of significant things happened in graduate school that helped to start to shine a light. One thing I remember was my fall quarter of school, which was the fall of 08, and I remember distinctly I was in Sedona, Arizona at a conference, and I was sitting outside on a patio with these beautiful red rocks around me, and I was reading an article that we'd been given from Mark Fromm in our mm-hmm. in our human development class, and it was an article from a magazine called Becoming Attached by Robert Caron. It's an excellent article. If anyone wants an overview of this world, I highly recommend this article. And as I read the article, I felt like it was talking right to me. And in the article, he quotes a song by Leonard Cohen, which is, it's about children, and they are leaning out for love, and they will lean that way forever. And that song that the line is from has been an anthem song of mine. And when I saw it in the article, it was one of those aha moments. Which I believe we all get these aha moments in life when we're on our path, sort of moving toward what I believe is the unique destiny that we each have. And for me to see that line in that article, on that patio, on that afternoon, that fall afternoon, was a real aha moment. Like it pointed me to what is attachment, this attachment stuff. I have to figure out more about this. And a few weeks later, I got together with some classmates, and we did a presentation on what is early attachment? And I guess I need to define what the heck I'm even talking about here. So what is early attachment, and how
sure.
does it affect our adult relationships?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, go ahead and weave it in. That's definitely something I wanted you to talk about. So, yes.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to back up and talk about what is attachment theory and how did it develop. So John Bowlby, Sir John Bowlby, who's a British psychiatrist and psychologist, psychoanalyst, who was born in 1907 and sort of came into prominence in the 50s and 60s and 70s, he's considered to be the father of attachment theory. And he himself has an interesting story. His father was the surgeon for the king, the king's family, the king household. And so he was raised in the upper classes in England, and he was in a culture where his mother would see him for 1 hour a day at tea time. That was considered what was appropriate for not spoiling a child, and for helping to have helping to support the culture so that the adult mother could have some freedom. She would have her own life, and she would have an appointment with her child for that tea time. So he was basically raised by a nanny who he had a very strong bond with. And when he was 4 years old, his nanny was fired or she left. And so he experienced a huge rupture in his early bonding. And I think because of this, he grew up and he studied psychology with this idea of wanting to understand his past. And the psychoanalytic tradition was really big at the time, Freud and Klein, and he was looking at their theory, and it just didn't add up for him. So he started to look outside of psychology. He had a friend who was an animal behaviorist, someone who studied animal behavior. He was influenced by that. He was influenced by systems theory. He was influenced by other kinds of sciences. And he looked at child development. So he looked at all these things that weren't being studied in the day as part of the main body of psychology. And he started to put together this other paradigm. And he basically was, he's the one who came up with and said that our evolutionary survival strategy, it's not about, you know, Freud talked about this drive for sex and a drive for aggression, that was like those were primary drives in the human. And Bowlby said, no, our primary drive is actually to bond. It's to protect our infants from predators at the very most basic level and to bond with our young ones to give them a sense of safety.
Mm-hmm.
And so he posited that all of us have a certain experience when we bond with our mothers and or our primary caretaker, and it creates the idea here is that our mother, if she has an intact nervous system, she transmits that nervous system to us through gazing, holding, and basic emotional attunement in the first years of life. And if she has an intact nervous system, she passes that on to us, and we have a sense of safety. We feel safe with ourselves, safe with her, safe in the world. According to a 1990 article, about two-thirds of American children have this intact nervous system. The other third of us have a nervous system that is not fully transmitted, mostly because, in most cases, it's because our parents didn't get intact nervous systems transmitted to them. So I said at the beginning, like, I was raised in this really, I had a very stable childhood, and yet I believe that my mother didn't have a fully intact nervous system because of the trauma that she went through and that her mother went through and that perhaps her mother's mother, et cetera, went through. So though she did her best, somehow I wasn't given a fully intact nervous system. In the theory, they call this an insecure attachment rather than a secure attachment.
And Shevlita, is this the same as anxious? I mean, are these interchangeable for you?
Right.
Insecure and anxious?
So if we say, if the very broad stroke is people are either, and in America, let's say two-thirds of us are securely wired, a third of us are insecurely wired. And then when it comes to the insecure types, there's two main flavors of insecure attachment. So maybe I'll go there next and say that Bowlby had an assistant named Mary Ainsworth, and they worked together. Mary's story, very briefly, is that she was born in 1913 in Ohio and raised in the States, studied psychology, met and married her husband, who was also studying psychology. He got a post in London. She went along with him to his post in London, and she needed a job, so she looked in the want ads, and John Bowlby was looking for an assistant, and she found the ad in the paper. They met up, and they started to work together. In their work together, she did some very amazing tests where she learned that what happens with a baby is that we are instinctively capable of bonding with our mother. And this is what we do. We seek proximity. We follow mama wherever she goes. We will coo if we're happy. Babies all over the world coo. And we'll cry if we're upset. And these are all like primary instinctive responses to saying, hey, Mom, I need attention. We use these ways to signal our need for attention and our appreciation for the attention that we're getting. So what she noticed is that that babies exhibited these primary responses, but certain babies, if those responses did not get, if the mother didn't respond to the cooing or the crying, mm-hmm. then these children would develop secondary responses, anger. They would get angry. And then they would express their anger in two different ways. And John Bowlby thought anger was very healthy. It's a way to say, yo, mama, hello. Very, very instinctual response. But mm-hmm. what would happen is in childhood homes where kids had to go to the secondary response all the time or more often than they wanted to, they would develop two ways. And here's what you were asking about attachment styles. There's two primary attachment styles for the insecure type. One is they hyperactivate. They get really big. They get really loud. They get demanding. They use what's called protest behavior. And those types who hyperactivate, the literature calls those, there's many, many names for it, but I'm going to call it a wave. We'll just call it waves. So waves have moms who sometimes are there and able to tune in and sometimes are preoccupied with something else, and they never quite know which mom they're going to get. So they get kind of wildly addicted to doing whatever they need to do to get mom to show up.
Mm-hmm.
So their behavior gets quite wavish. So that's the one type. That's about 10%. Again, in 1990, they did a study, and it's about 10% of U.S. babies.
Okay.
The other way babies go when they are angry and they're not getting the response they want is they learn how to deactivate their nervous system. So they hypoactivate instead of hyperactivate. And when one hypoactivates, what happens is I will act like I don't need you. I will actually turn all of my emotional systems down, so I'm not even feeling my emotions anymore. Those types of people, some people call them avoidance.
Mm-hmm.
Some people call them dismissive types. For the sake of this hour, I'm going to borrow from Stan Tatkin, who I study with, and he calls them islands. So under distress, an island an island is pulled into themselves. So if you look at a videotape of a child, Mom Lee, say it's a study, one of Mary Ainsworth studies, she'll have a child and an adult in the room together, the parent. The parent leaves. The child acts like, poof, no big deal. The parent comes back. The child ignores the parent and just plays with its toys. This is characteristic of an avoidant response. Because a healthy child will cry when mom leaves. And a healthy child will be really happy to see mom and hug mom and bond with mom for a minute and then resume play.
Okay. And we're talking about what age groups were they studying this with?
So Mary Ainsworth is the woman who took John Bowlby's theory, and she really put it on the map through doing all these laboratory studies, both mm-hmm. in the States and in England and then also in Africa. She went to Uganda and did the same tests there to see cross-culturally if the results would be the same, and they were. Tell me your question again.
Sorry, so when she was doing this study with these infants, from what ages was it, from, 3 months
okay,
to a year? Or?
So she had she would spend 72 hours with the child from birth to the first year. So she and her crew would go to their homes and study the infant in the home with the mother or the primary caregiver. And then when the child was a year old, she'd bring them into the lab and she'd do this experiment where she'd have the child and the parent in the lab, and then the mother would leave and come back. And she saw these very distinctive patterns, two of which I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, just to answer your question, so it was about a year of age.
Okay. And
so,
then the third, there's a third type.
Right. So the third, so the secure types, they happily are in the room with mom. They play, they go back to mom. They play, they go back to mom. Mom leaves, they cry. Mom comes back, they reunite, and they resume play. The avoidant child, let's go to the wave next. For the wave, when mom and child are in the room together, the wave child doesn't want to play. They stay really close to mom. They hide in mom's skirt. They cling to mom. They don't feel so safe to go and play, even when she's in the room. When she leaves, they cry, just like the secure child.
Mm-hmm.
When mom comes back in, they go toward mom for the comfort, just like the secure child, but they usually exhibit a different behavior as well, which is they get into mom's arms, and then they will get angry, and they'll arch their back sometimes and scream and cry. So there's a way that they won't let themselves be soothed by mom.
Mm.
That's the wave. And then the island kind of ignores mom. Mom leaves. They're fine. Mom comes back. They still seem fine. They just stay in their own little world. And the interesting thing is that eventually Ainsworth put probes on these kids that looks like the island kids, and it turns out that their heart was beating. They're very activated, but the way they handle their activation is they withdraw and they stay separate from mom. So those are the three types.
Like pretending I don't need you, but inside all systems were just firing go. But,
exactly. So that's why we have these two categories. You're either secure or you're anxious. And if you're anxious, it looks like one of these two forms. You either go wave or you go island, typically.
Okay. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I was going to ask you to, if you could then with that, thank you for that overview of that. And then if you wanted to weave that back into where you left us with you.
I think I'm going to go a little more into what happened. Because for those folks that are listening, I'm guessing most of you are grown up and most of you are in relationships, and you might be wondering, how does all this stuff with kids have to do with my adult relationship, my romantic relationship, you know, as advertised on the podcast today?
Right. Okay. You go.
So let me go there, and then if it makes sense, I'll weave my story back in.
Okay. That sounds good.
Okay. So island and wave are the terms I'm using. Anchor for the secure types, and then island or wave for the other two types. And I want to give you other terminology that you may have heard in your life. A pairing I've heard for a long time to do with adult relationships is pursuer and distancer. Oh, yeah, he's the pursuer, I'm the distancer, or vice versa. One pursues, one distances. In other bodies of knowledge, they call it the caretaker and the loner. The codependent being the wave, and the alcoholic or addict being more the island type.
Mm-hmm.
Sue Johnson, who's a very famous therapist doing this kind of work, she's spread this work all over the world, she calls the wave the blamer, and she calls the island the withdrawer.
Mm-hmm.
There's also fuser and isolator. So there's these different ways that these types tend to get paired up with each other. It's not always the case, but more often than not, a wave will grow up and end up with an island. An island will grow up and end up with a wave. So in some ways, you can even reduce all this down to Buddhist thought, they talk about desire and aversion.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, you could almost say that wave behavior is when we are caught up in desire, clinging, wanting, grasping. And aversive behavior is when we get caught up in pushing away and turning away and trying to stop thinking about something. It's the very same principles.
Mm-hmm. And the reason that these two often end up together in relationship is?
That is a great question that I'm not sure I can answer right now.
Okay.
But maybe what I can do...
Well, you can keep going with where you were going.
Yeah.
That was just something that popped up for me. But, yeah, please continue.
Yeah, I think I can explain it this way. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how these different types behave in relationships.
Okay.
So for example, waves tend to be – okay, so talking about nervous system again, people that are securely attached feel safe in the world, feel safe in their body, feel safe with their people. They know when they get emotionally dysregulated, they know how to regulate themselves. They know how to calm themselves down, soothe themselves, They know how to motivate themselves. They know how to kind of guide themselves to ideal functioning, you know, or basic good functioning.
Mm-hmm.
People that don't have the full transmission, the us insecure types, we regulate different ways. So, for example, I consider myself a wave. And when I'm upset, I often need to talk to people. I get on the phone with a friend. Sometimes I can't function unless I get on the phone with a friend. I will be collapsed on my bed, say, it's happened to me many times, until I call a friend and get somebody to listen to me, and I cry or I rage or I do what I need to do, and then I start to feel okay again. So we waves are considered to be external regulators. We need something on the outside to help us, a person on the outside to help us regulate our nervous system.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we go over to the island type, they're considered, and this is Stan Patkin's work I'm drawing from here, they are considered auto-regulators. So when things get stressful for them, they don't seek another person to talk to. That hasn't proven to be very safe for them in their world. And again, we haven't talked about like why these kids develop the way they do. There's a whole story behind how they show up in the lab at age one. But let's just say we see their behavior, we see them grow up. An island has something distressful happen to them, and what they do is they just want to go away, because what they've learned is that what's going to calm them down is not to go to another person. What they don't know how to calm themselves down very well, so what they'll do is they'll often go watch TV or play a video game, or they'll do something where they're kind of entertaining themselves, and that's their way of trying to regulate their nervous system.
Yeah, and escape, basically.
And kind of escape, yeah. And escape, yeah, as a means to just get calm.
Yeah.
They're just trying to, we either are calm or we're trying to get calm most of the mm-hmm. time. So if mm-hmm. you don't know how to get calm, yeah, you'll escape if that's what works for you to get calm. That's what you'll keep mm-hmm. doing. It's like, it's the way we medicate. You know, if I can't regulate myself, I'm going to turn to any medication / addiction that's going to help me calm down.
Mm-hmm.
Or pep up, depending on, you know, what's required of the moment. So the islands in the world, they become sort of our master autonomy people. There was a beautiful study done in Israel. The subjects were members of the Israeli army, and the people that went over there were coding them for their attachment style. And what they discovered is that the islands had gifts and the waves had gifts. The gift of the wave is that they are on high alert all the time. They are always looking for something wrong in the environment. And they're going to protest as soon as they find it. They're going to be like, that's a problem. And so in a wartime situation, they are often the ones who see danger first.
Mm.
So that's the gift of the wave. The gift mm-hmm. of the island is that because they have this high self-preservation, you know, this capacity to want to escape and take care of themselves, you know, me first,
mm-hmm.
where that turns into an asset is that if there's a situation where a group is under threat, the island is going to be the first one to be like, hey, I'm out of here. They're going to be the first one to activate out. And so they become leaders in a way of the whole troop, because when they start to go, everybody else will follow them.
Oh, interesting.
So you can see how each type has its domain. In relationship world, you know, if we take it out of the war setting and put it in just to a traditional everyday relationship, romantic relationship, a wave is going to often be the one in charge of connecting. Hey, honey, get off the computer. Come and have dinner with me. Hey, honey, I need a hug before you go off to the day. Give me a hug. So the waves are really good at connecting. The islands are really good at making sure that the couple has autonomy. Like, okay, babe, we've been watching, you know, we've been doing this activity together for 3 hours. Like, I need to go take a run.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, I'm gonna go off with my friends. I'll be back later, which then causes the other partner to have to do something with themselves. So in a balanced relationship where a wave might actually seek an island because an island's going to help them have a life. And an
mm-hmm.
island might seek a wave because a wave is going to help them have a social calendar.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense. When I say
totally
have a life,
makes sense.
I mean, yeah. So
yes,
that's,
yes.
And so you can see because of those principles alone that they're kind of like opposites attract.
Mm-hmm. And so far it's sounding like, in, you know, with the normal ups and downs of a relationship that, that may be there, it could be, it could actually be a good, a pretty good match. But I guess when we go further out, oh, actually, this is something I wanted to ask you about. It's related to this in a way, this matching up of, but would you say, is it safe to say or fair to say that there's actually a continuum with this? In other words, are you not necessarily,
yes.
Okay, yeah, you're not necessarily just a wave or just anxious or just secure, but there's a line and you can fall sort of anywhere. You can have shades of waviness or, right?
Yeah, and that's a great point because you can have shades of things. You can also, if you do a lot of self-work, you can develop much more secure functioning but still get kind of wavy under a lot of stress or get islandy under a lot of stress. I personally have watched with my friends and experienced in myself that I'll be wavy with one person, which is my predominant style is wave. But if I'm with someone who's even wavier than I am, I become an island.
Uh-huh.
So some of these behaviors are, and these patterns are very archetypal. And so if we, you know, if someone is acting really coming at me and demanding things of me, my natural response is to, may, you know, if I don't know better, is to want to withdraw and escape. It sort of makes common sense.
Finding equal,
so yes,
what equilibrium
so we do
is.
Mm-hmm. Right,
right. Right. Okay. So I'm also. Did you want to? I don't want to break your train.
I can keep going, but I think your questions are refreshing and a nice break from my voice.
Okay.
Please ask them.
Okay. Well, I wanted to bring in, because this was also, you know, something that was in the description of the neuroplasticity and rewiring. So if, I guess we would need to maybe go a little bit more into, though, how this plays out into relationships where it becomes not so healthy or difficult,
not so
and then we can talk about a little bit about the wiring.
Exactly.
Okay.
And it's the way that it doesn't work is fairly simple to explain, and probably a lot of you out there who might be listening have experienced the downside. It goes like this: when we go into the more distressing patterns when we don't feel secure. So if I come home, if I'm a wave, and I come home. And you're on your computer for 4 hours, and you say hi to me, but you don't get up and give me a hug. You know, at hour one and a half or two, I might start to freak out, and I might start to become a little more wavish. I might come over to you and say, "Hey, I've been home for an hour and a half. Like, do I get a hug?" So I've lost some skill there, and I'm starting to go into protest behavior because that's what I'm wired to do. I feel unsafe. I feel insecure, and it's getting triggered right now. And so I'm going to go into wavish behavior. Then you as an island, you see this big wave coming at you, and your first instinct might be to want to escape and be like, "Hey, I just, leave me alone. I've got to finish this project. You know how important this project is to me. Like, just leave me alone for a minute. I'll come out when I can, okay?" And so the island's natural instinct there is to want to move away from that big wave. So you can see, though, if these types don't get a hold of what's happening, if they don't understand, you know, Sue Johnson, again, who's a therapist I refer to, who has been the person, I think, most responsible for spreading these practices of how to work with these attachment styles around the world. She says when a couple fight, and I think this might be on the website, on your page, but when a couple fights, within even 2 seconds of a fight, if you slow it down or freeze frame it, and you get underneath what's happening, almost always it's a fight about security. In other words, whatever the partner's doing, whether they're getting big or whether they're kind of pulling back and running away, they're both saying, "Hey, do I matter to you? Do you care about me? Like, can't you see? Don't you know?" Like, these super basic questions are at the root of almost every fight. They're basically attachment questions. Like, "Hey, I want to know you're there for me and that you understand me and that you can support me."
Mm-hmm.
And so, if we understand that that's what's going on, we can stop this kind of snowball effect and we can find new ways to connect with our partner. But if we don't know that that's the real conversation that's happening, then we just take everything at face value, and when they push us away, we feel rejected.
Right.
And when I feel rejected, I'm going to get angrier. So there's a snowball effect. If we don't see, oh, what's really going on is these two people are trying their best to find a way to express their attachment needs to each other.
Yes.
So that's what the work is. That's what the work is.
Okay, that's great. You explained that really well. Thank you. Because, yeah, otherwise it sounds like it just comes down to blaming the behavior, blaming the person. Well, you're like this, and well, you're too much like this, and you're not enough like
right.
this, then it stays
right.
at that level, you know?
Right, and we become experts at describing the pathology of our partner, and we are expert at that, yay, but it's not helping us solve the problem and get the closeness that we want.
Exactly. So would this be a good moment to bring in one
Chopin?
Of the commandments?
Yes, in fact, let's just switch there. And suffice to say, just to tie the loop on my own story, is I realized that I have a really rocky relationship history. My longest relationship, I'm, you know, almost 50. My longest relationship is 2 years. I got to play out over and over again. I would either end up being the island or the wave. Mostly I was a wave in relationship, and I would find islands. Occasionally I flip-flopped. And I got to really see how these dynamics were getting in the way of me having a good relationship. And then I got to discover that it's because my wiring isn't really sound, because my mother's wiring isn't really sound, because her mother's wiring wasn't really sound, etc. I got to really see what I could do myself to change my attachment style, and then what I could do in relationships so that I could create more secure relationships with others.
Mm-hmm.
So I can talk about the Ten Commandments, or I can talk about what people can do individually, and they're both really valuable. But since the theme of the show is about, you know, what can we do in relationships, regardless of what our type is, what I want to share are 10 principles that will help any relationship, no matter what the dynamic is. It will help the relationship
Can I ask you something here, though?
Secure functioning.
I'm sorry, can I ask you something here about
Sure,
before you go into the Ten Commandments or the essentials, would you share one or two things with us that worked for you personally in the process? Unless they're already in the commandments.
They're in the commandments, so maybe I'll leave it in as I talk about the commandments. And the commandments, I stole the Ten Commandments from Stan Tatkin. He wrote out 10 commandments, and he discloses very openly that he wrote these commandments, you know, on a deadline, late at night, I think it was, on a deadline, without giving it a whole lot of thought. So I looked over his 10 commandments because I really respect Stan's work, what he's doing with attachment. And I also looked in some other places, other sources. There's a book, for example, called Attach. It's a great kind of 101 for somebody who wants to understand attachment and how it applies to their relationship. So they have principles in there too. So kind of blended different worlds to come up with, I like your terminology, Lena, like these 10 essentials. And I just want to see what our time is. Okay, we have about a third left. So
and we
a quarter
and
left.
Yeah, if we're not able to go through necessarily every single one, but at least, well, we did promise the 10, so we'll do our best, but at least what you would consider the most pertinent, if they're not in that order.
Yeah, I'll do that. And I'll also say that I'm in the process of building a Facebook page called Understanding Attachment, and you can get to it through my website, and I will have my essentials on that site. And this, too, is a work in progress, just like my whole talking today is a work in progress. These essentials are going to be a work in progress as well. So just starting at the top for now, some of the ones that I think are really important. And I'll start with one that was really crucial for me, which is be available. Be available. So what that means is that when you're in a relationship, actually commit to being in a relationship. Especially for waves, we have a real tendency to stay on the fence. Some people call this type ambivalent type. It's going back to the child. It's like the child runs towards mommy when mommy comes back. I run towards you, mommy, but I'm also mad at you for not being there when you were supposed to. So I both want you and I don't want you. And there's this kind of ambivalent patterning that gets created within us that we act out in all areas of our life as we grow up into adulthood. So for me, it took me, in my most recent relationship, the one I'm currently in, it took me a few months to realize that the ambivalence was kind of running the show. I was kind of into it, and I kind of wasn't, and every time I would speak to a friend, I'd say, well, here are the really great things, and here are my concerns. And I wasn't sounding like somebody who was newly in love, is what I realized eventually. Like, I wasn't having that honeymoon experience. And so be available is the idea of getting off the fence in a relationship and either getting out or putting both feet in. And for me, it was a very, it was just a decision I made, and there was a lot of, it wasn't much. It was a decision I made at home alone one night, but it really changed how I showed up in the relationship. So for people
listening who recognize, well, I see myself in this, and this is a challenge for me. I mean, is it just to say, one, okay, to be aware, which is always the first step, that's a pattern, and then simply, would you say, I mean, simply deciding? I mean,
it's acknowledging, like you say, awareness and acknowledging the ambiguity and knowing that that's just something that wave types especially have, is we have this inner ambiguity, and to acknowledge that, like, I'm not clear. I have a yes in one hand and a no in the other, and to be okay with that. And then, yes, eventually to just choose one and go with it and not to stay on that fence. You know, come down from the fence already. So to actually make a choice, either with your partner or on your own, and just notice what happens. It's like an experiment. You make a choice, and then you follow it out, and you see what happens. In my case, I followed it out, and I realized my relationship got a lot easier for me and a lot more, I just got a lot more settled about it.
Mm-hmm. And I guess I can share one thing too, if it's helpful, is that in a past relationship, I used to be on the fence as well, often one foot in, one foot out. And I simply told myself, as a way to calm myself down, okay, I'm going to go both feet in, but sort of one look at it, one date at a time, and not look too far ahead. Well, what does this mean? Well, what if this and what if that? And just told myself it's going to keep revealing itself to me. I don't have to know. I think there's this idea, like, we want to know if it's going to work. We want to know if it's going to be okay. And we can't know in the beginning. I think that what helped me was the inner dialogue of just telling myself, it's going to tell me whether or not to keep going.
Nice.
That may or may not be helpful. But
that's okay, great. Actually think you gave me that advice early on in this relationship. I think I remember you saying that to me, and it was helpful.
Ah, okay, good. Yes, I remember that now too. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so I want to make sure to hit at least two more before we end the call today.
Yes.
So another essential is to realize that our job is to, that we are responsible for our well-being and our partner's well-being. This is a secure principle. Some people disagree with it and say it can start to look like codependency. But the codependency is when I'm all focused on you, but not me. Mm-hmm. Selfishness is when I'm focused on me, but not you. So the principle here is to really think of ourselves as a we. Think in the we terms. Again, really helped me to start thinking in the we instead of just, oh, am I in or am I out? But we, oh, it's a we. And I'm actually responsible for taking care of your needs equally as much as I'm responsible for taking care of my own. The way Stan puts it is that we are all a proxy for our partners. We represent all the parenting they got and all the parenting they didn't get. So any wounds that they bring into the relationship, we're going to be the parent that's there to help them with their wounding. We're going to be the person that can be there for them when anything happens. We are the go-to person. And so to remember to take responsibility for your partner as well as your own well-being.
I like that. Yeah, it's interdependence, you know.
Interdependence, nicely said in one word. Another key one is to realize that when we fight, when we to see if we can repair a rupture as soon as possible. Stan talks about after it usually and a lot of people concur with this, that it takes about 30 minutes for a nervous system that gets activated and flooded to calm down. Some people can do it faster. I do it pretty quickly. Some people take, they say physiologically it can take 25 to 30 minutes. If you're angry with your partner after 30 minutes, there's another thing going on that needs attending to. It's become a psychological issue, according to some, rather than a physiological issue. Because after 30 minutes, anybody should, who takes a break for 30 minutes should theoretically be able to come back and do a repair with their partner. And anytime we wait longer than 30 minutes, so I love how Stan puts this, he says it's like we start to get into long-term memory. And if you put a bad experience where you feel yucky, you feel like you want to die, you feel like you hate your partner, if that goes into long-term memory, that becomes associated with the relationship and with the person. So if you can make amends and do a repair in that first 30 minutes or in the first hour, you can you don't have to lay down a bad memory in your brain.
And that's the wiring. That's part of wiring as well.
Part of the wiring, sure.
Yeah, and also that explains when people bring up something, when they get upset and then they bring up a litany of things from a year ago and 5 years ago, and you know, that's what you're speaking
right.
to.
Right. Which is another essential, which is when you're fighting, stick with one thing at a time. Do your best, even though you want to bring up that thing that happened 5 years ago, write it down and come back to it when you're calm, when you and your partner are in a good place. When you're in a fight, fight about the one thing that's in front of you. And, you know, avoid character assassination. Avoid bringing in all these other topics that are related. Avoid major judging and labeling. Stick with the one behavior that's on the table and ameliorate that.
That's very sound advice.
A way that they talk about it, I think, yeah, in Attaches, they say, douse the flame before it becomes a forest fire. Mm-hmm. That's a way to kind of sum up the last two principles there. Sorry, were you going to say a little more there?
No.
Okay, let's see how we're doing.
We're doing good. We're doing well.
We're doing good, yeah. Here's another one. To learn good communication skills, which is kind of an obvious one, but especially for insecure types, it's so easy for us to make assumptions because it's just easy for us to make the wrong assumptions because we don't grow up with a nervous system that thinks all is well, all is well, all is well. So we tend to assume the worst when anything starts to happen in our environment. If we start to get threatened, which happens to us more easily, we assume the worst. So one way to help that is to have a really good communication style with your partner, to be able to ask for what you need instead of assuming the worst. Waves especially tend to just assume and they want all this change and they're waiting for all this change, but they don't actually ask for it. So being able to ask clearly and in a responsible way, at Stanford we talk about staying on your side of the net. So instead of saying, hey, you're doing this, and I really hated it, and I wish you would blah, 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 I stay on my side of the net, and I say, I'm noticing I feel a certain way when I observe you doing this very observable behavior that I'm not going to lay a bunch of judgment on. Just when you, I notice that when you don't take out the trash every Monday morning, I notice I feel upset about that, and I'm wondering, would you be willing to be a little more mindful about the trash on Sunday night?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a way for me to communicate my feeling in a way that's not attacking or blaming. I'm staying in my business, talking about my my state rather than telling you all about yours.
Mm-hmm.
And then I make a simple request.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to say one more and close out with an example of that one. Stan really talks about the importance of making agreements, of having a constitution with your partner or any of your loved ones if you can, so that when people start to get activated, that they have something they can fall back on, an agreement that they've made. Like, okay, when we're both yelling at each other, the agreement is the person who notices it first will leave the room. They will leave the room no matter what. And then we agree we'll come back in 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm. And so I just have a quick question. Quick question about the Constitution. Is that literally writing out the agreement or just verbally agreeing?
Yeah, I mean, depending on how you work with your partner, but at the most basic level, yeah, write it down and put it on the refrigerator if you need to. So it's something you can actually both point back to, especially when you're both sideways.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
So making agreements. And I want to tell this. I want to close out, like I say, on this story of a couple that came to see a therapist working on attachment stuff. And their dilemma was, in the morning, she was a wave, and she always wanted a hug in the morning. It's really important that she got some bonding with her guy before he got up and got out of bed. She would be upset if she didn't get that. It would throw her day off. Conversely, he would wake up in the morning and he would be laying in bed. He'd be writing his to-do list, and he couldn't wait to just get up out early in the morning and get going on stuff. And this became the wave and the island. They were snowballing in this apartment. Every morning they would end up getting in a big fight, and it would throw mm-hmm. both of their days off. And so the agreement that they made through a role play that they did in therapy, the agreement went like this. The wave would practice asking for her hug. She would practice asking for it instead of hoping for it and waiting for it. She'd ask. And the island, he would comply. He would go for the hug. He would hug her for a little while. And then she would pay attention to when he was starting to squirm. And mm-hmm. and she would learn when that point was. And before he would start to squirm, she would be in charge of releasing him. So she'd release him before he was feeling trapped. That way mm-hmm. she got her hug, and he got to preserve a sense of contributing to his wife but still preserving his freedom along the way. And this is a way that they could work with each other's style. And this is an agreement they came up with.
That's a really nice example, and I imagine that had it's seemingly kind of small. If you hear it, you think, well, a hug, you know, how difficult it is to give a hug, et cetera. But, of course, when you lay it out dynamically like that, you see what's at play. And so it kind of like just one thing like that, I'm sure, reverberated in a pretty significant way.
Yeah, I mean, it can be kind of a template that you can use in all kinds of different situations.
Yeah, exactly. No, the agreements, but that particular agreement, you know,
yeah, that
rather
particular
than
one, right.
Mm-hmm, right, rather than setting their days off askew, you know, they got off to a really different start. And
Yeah. And hugging, by the way, is a great thing. Stan often recommends couples, especially when they're insecure types, that they hug when they get home for a couple of minutes until they both, you know, long enough for one to feel settled but not too long so that the other one doesn't feel trapped. And that the hug is a wonderful way to recalibrate security and prime the couple for security. And some couples, he'll have them hug every time they cross paths in the house through a day.
Uh-huh.
You know, every few hours, every time they change rooms, he'll have them do a hug. Again, just the right amount that works for both parties. And mm-hmm. this is a way to prime the relationship for secure functioning.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm off on a tangent, and I think we're about out of time.
No, we're good. I think we have about just over 5 minutes left, and so I was wondering, okay. there was one of them that said, putting the partner to bed each night and awakening with the partner each morning. Is he suggesting that people, it's better, it's a primer to go to bed together and at the same
time?
Yeah,
and again, not everybody agrees with this, but Stan believes, again, and I'm using this concept of priming for security. So there's been mm-hmm. Philip Shaver out of UC Davis has done a lot of studies where if you subliminally put words in a person's head, like love, being loved, warmth, and then you engage them in some kind of a discussion, they will behave in a more secure fashion if they've had these subliminal words put into their head. And you can put other happy words like humor or success, and it won't have the same effect. But if you put in the words love, being loved, caring, words that have to do with human bonding, that it actually affects the way a person thinks, feels, and behaves. So Stan, I believe, takes that principle, and he's, you know, but so if you go to bed at the same time, wake up at the same time as your partner, it primes you for feeling secure and connected. And again, it kind of can set your day off on a good note if you have that waking up experience together.
Yes. And
versus
all these things.
If,
oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Just one more sentence. Versus if you are very disconnected, behavior then starts to look like threatening behavior all the time. So then you're priming your relationship for threat. So then something as innocuous as like, oh, my God, where's the mayonnaise, starts to sound to your partner like you're threatening them. Like, oh, my God, where the bleep is the mayonnaise?
Mm-hmm.
So you want to be priming for security rather than priming for threat. Especially
yes, and
for insecure types who need that extra priming anyway. That's all I was going to say.
No, thank you. Yeah, I was just going to say, in all what you've been telling us about the priming and these behaviors and ways to communicate, these all literally help to rewire the nervous system. Is that language that you would use,
right,
or rewire the brain?
Right, just to bring it full circle, yeah, that we have the capacity to get, so it's about this initial transmission. And if we don't get that transmission through the eyes and the hugging and the attunement, if we don't get that from our primary caregiver, we can get it from a therapist, from a partner. We can even, in some degrees, we can get it from a spiritual symbol or a pet. There's all these different ways that we can continue to download the wiring, the safety and the security, that transmission that we need, so that we develop the parts of our brain that allow us to move through the world feeling safe and secure. That our brains are plastic, and even if they didn't get them out the gate, we can find other ways to continue that development so that we do become inherently safe and secure beings.
Yeah, which is a very positive and uplifting, you know, that is not deterministic, essentially, which is what I love about
it.
We're wired a certain way, but we're not hardwired, and that's what I really love about this, is that it's very super hopeful. Yeah, perfect.
Yeah.
So we just have about 2 minutes left. Do you want to let people know how they can reach you, the websites, and anything else that you want to say?
Oh, so funny. I feel like such a big girl. Yes, you can reach me. I work with my business partner, Elliot Scuderi, and my land partner. I live with he and his wife and son. He and I do couples work together. We teach these principles, and we help couples shift from threat to security. We have a website called RelationshipEcologyInstitute.com, Relationship Ecology Institute. I have a Facebook page, my own Facebook page, which is Shevelisa Brazzoni Psychotherapy. Not three words, none of which are easy to spell. But my name is on Lena's, on the Inner Spark website. If you want to refer to my name, you can get to my website. And I'm building a Facebook page, which hopefully will become a website on its own, called Understanding Attachment, because I really want people to have a lot of resources available to them if they want to learn what's out there in terms of understanding this field and all the people that have contributed to it.
Perfect. Oh, I knew this was going to be really valuable conversation. Like I said, you just have so much insight and your passion, and you really wove everything together so nicely in terms of the history and just brought it down to a really practical, understandable level. So thank you so much, Shevelisa. It was really great having you on the show, and I know people are going to get a lot from this.
No, you're welcome, Lena. You're welcome, and it's an honor to be having a conversation with you, so thank you, too.
Oh, thanks. And thanks, everyone, for listening, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.